Please welcome our two guests this morning. You just saw his picture up there, Bob Brocklehurst, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, earned his wings in 1941. Bob?
Yay, Bob.
Thank you.
And Karen Abel on his left. Karen started, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but you became involved with learning about the Aleutian campaign because of your grandfather, who was a P-40 pilot, right?
That is, yep, that's right.
And how old were you when you learned about this? How did you learn about his experience?
When he passed in 1996, we discovered an entire briefcase full of his logbooks, photos, newspaper clippings, communications that he had had with the Department of Defense. And that's what got me interested. I didn't do anything about it until 2012.
But in just the last 6 years, though, you have become apparently the most expert historian on the planet on the Aleutian campaign.
No, first of all, no expert, just very passionate about wanting to know about the campaign. It's not a very well-known campaign. It's equally as valuable to any other campaign out there. And right. As I started to talk about it in 2012, to just people I knew in my community or even in World War II historians or people who were enthusiasts about the war, they didn't know that campaign even happened. And it just inspired me to tell the story of those who served out there.
Bob?
Yes, sir.
Your wings in 1941, how did you learn that you would be going to Alaska?
Well, after graduating September 1941, assigned to Selfridge Field, Michigan, P-40s, under Jack Chennault, one of the seven sons of General Chennault of Chinese fame. And on Saturday after Pearl Harbor Day, we were on a troop train headed for California to pick up P-40s from the depot to fly to Alaska.
And what was that flight like? Now think 1941 flying to Alaska. What was that experience like?
Well, some of us had as many as 15 hours in a P-40. Others had as little as 8. The airplanes became available by 2s and 3s. And as they became available, they drew numbers. The senior people took the first airplanes. And when mine came up, there was two other guys and myself. It took us from December of 41 to I finally landed in Alaska March the 5th, 1942, with the last of the flights due to a lot of circumstances. We lost 6 out of 24 airplanes on the way up, lost 1 pilot and 1 aircraft after we got there due to a lot of circumstances, airplane problems. They were building the Alaskan Highway then, and we landed at remote airfields that they were just recently made, refueled out of drums to refuel our airplanes, and then we learned to fly in Alaska.
How did you navigate to get up there?
Well, we didn't have any navigation past Edmonton, and not too much there. We did have some hand-drawn maps about this big that airline pilots had made, but the rest of it was just flying a heading and a route through Fort St. John, Fort Nelson, Whitehorse, and on up to Fairbanks, and then down to Anchorage.
So you land in Alaska. At what point do you begin to fly down the islands?
Well, there was the 18th Fighter Squadron up there with P-36s, and we had P-40s with the 11th Squadron we'd bid to come. And after we got up there and flew for a while, they decided, because the 18th Squadron had the old P-36s. The new squadron with junior second lieutenants had the P-40s. They swapped us half and half, took our airplanes with us. And when we got, I got transferred to the 18th, and they took the senior second lieutenant just took our P-40s away from us, and we got the P-36s. But it was the best thing, because they knew, had some experience flying in the Alaskan weather out of Anchorage. They taught us how to fly, and that really saved a bunch of our lives flying out down the Aleutian.
Try to describe for us what it was like flying down to the islands. Terms of weather?
Well, you got 250 days of bad weather, rain, snow, fog. Temperatures weren't too bad. I think the mean temperature was somewhere around 38 degrees, but there was no nav aids. It's 1,500 miles in the southwest corner of Alaska, clear out there at two, including the Alaska Peninsula. And you could, you had a lot of bad weather. You had the fog banks, and you couldn't depend on the fog, but as you could, quick as you can snap your fingers, in a day like today, a snowstorm or rainstorm would blow it down off the mountains, and you'd had no visibility whatsoever. We flew, we got our scrambles, never seemed to catch anything, but we would take off under as low as a 300-foot ceiling, and we would not climb up through unless we had some indication that you could see mountain tops above the overcast, which we could go up and be on top of the then undercast, and you could go be vectored out for maybe an hour over the Pacific or somewhere, and then released. You'd come back and find a mountaintop that you knew and let down through and break out.
What's the term willy-wah mean?
Well, the winds are generally from the north, and it's just like a water behind a dam. You get a break in the dam or in the floods today, and that water suddenly twists and pours through the gap and speeds up. And you could have up to 100-mile-an-hour wind, maybe more. I know of a PBY that was tore up by it, and it would really bounce you around and twist you around. We generally flew in the P-40s level or higher than the mountaintops to avoid it if we flew on the south side of the chain, and or we flew on the north side.
Describe the weather, Karen. You know, that just...
It's like the Venturi effect, where the speed increases and it's twisting and turning. And in the P-40s, if you hit one, it would bounce you around real good. And I didn't taste more than one or two because we avoided them. There were airplanes tore up by them. There were airplanes on the ground tore up now and then if they were near an airfield or something like that. But basically, you avoided the willy-wah.
When you were a squadron commander at this point, yes?
Well, I was a squadron commander from in 43 to September 43 when I left.
How much combat flying did you actually do during that period?
Well, you know, we never counted sorties or anything. All we did, we flew alerts, we flew patrols, we flew vectors. But with clouds and anything, we never caught anybody. I think there was about, the statistics are true, there's about 45 Japanese airplanes shot down up there. But we lost about 185 due to weather and accidents. We were, the worldwide statistics show something like a 4 enemy shot down to 1 American lost. By accidents or whatever. Up in Alaska, it was just the opposite. We lost about 185 airplanes, 4-1 in accidents and weather. And at one time, I knew almost 100 airplanes myself that were lost due to weather.
Did you ever be in a situation where you led a bunch of other airplanes through terrible weather?
Yes, sir. That well, not nothing we couldn't handle, but we did, yes. It was typical to take off under as low as a, without fog, 300-foot ceiling, you could see for miles. So you had good visibility, and as long as the overcast, I see, as long as the mountaintops were sticking up so you could find one you knew to let down, it was typical. I took 12 airplanes on the way to ADAC at ATCA, and we were all landing in string, and as I was landing, a snowstorm came off the just northwest corner of the runway, and had to go on instruments, so I yelled, "I'm going around," because I knew my guys couldn't land, and so I went around, and there's a big hole out there, nice weather, even less clouds of the day here, and I got out, and I only got 11 airplanes. I got one missing, but he had landed, and I didn't know it was. We flew out for 45 minutes, the storm cleared, went back and landed. A normal type of procedure, really, and it was my wingman, and he was climbing into his airplane to go join us, because I had a solid rule, you will not break formation, and he broke formation. But that was sort of typical. It happened quite often.